Yeah, most overwhelmingly humbled to have Dr. Cook with us here today, Dr. Kenneth Cook. He'll be talking about the autonomic nervous system, POTS, and gastroparesis. My name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I'm a longtime patient with chronic intestinal food obstruction, gastroparesis, gastroesophageal reflux, achalasia, diffuse esophageal spasm, and many other medical problems. And I'm honored to serve as a volunteer for the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or AGMD. AGMD is a nonprofit organization.
It serves as an integral educational resource
for digestive motility disorders. It also functions as an information clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities. And in addition, it provides a form of support for patients and their families suffering from these motility disorders. During the first part of the program, we ask that you do not pose any questions to Dr. Cook because we have reserved the second part specifically for that reason. Assisting with the program, I have Melissa Adams Van Outen, who I'll ask to introduce herself. Melissa?
Hi, thank you. My name is Melissa Adams Van Houten, and I was diagnosed with gastroparesis a little over 7 years ago in February of 2014. I currently serve as the AGMD's Public Policy and Outreach Director, and I manage several online patient support and advocacy groups. I'm very happy to have you on the call today.
Melissa will be leading the question and answer part of the program, so thank you for doing that, Melissa. Dr. Cook, once again, we're thrilled to have you with us today and to talk about these topics as they relate to gastroparesis. So starting right in, can you explain what the autonomic nervous system is and what it does?
Yes, thank you. Well, hello, everybody, and glad you're listening in. While we tackle these kind of not one, not two, but kind of three difficult areas. So, yes, autonomic nervous system. And so I'll just kind of describe it in general terms. You might think of it as the automatic nervous system. So this system takes care of organs that you don't really want to think about. We don't think about, you know, our breathing and how oxygen is being exchanged. We don't think about how much blood our heart is pumping minute by minute. And actually for the GI tract, when it's working well, it should be just comfortable as the gallbladder, the pancreas, the stomach, the small bowel. I mean, all these organs I just mentioned, heart, lung, and GI, are built to do their job without us consciously thinking about most of their processes. So the autonomic nervous system, you know, also takes care of our vascular, you know, blood pressure, the kidneys. It's an important system, and it's part of the central nervous system. Located more like in the brain stem. It's where these, some people even call them vegetative kind of processes take place. And of course, it's very sophisticated. It's based on a lot of signals coming from, for instance, the GI tract. There are always signals coming up to and through the autonomic nervous system, because this system is constantly monitoring what we need to survive and to do well and to thrive. For example, should our heart rate right now, as you're sitting in a chair perhaps comfortably, you know, should our heart rate be slow, medium, fast? Should our breathing rate be slow, medium, fast? You could even say, should digestion right now be slow or, you know, shut down? Or should it be normal? These are all, you might say, measurements done for us by the autonomic nervous system. And so, you know, the autonomic nervous system hears what's happening in these organs. And of course, we're most interested in the GI tract. what is the autonomic nervous system hearing from the track? And then also the track has to respond to what we see, what we're seeing, what we're hearing, what we're tasting, what are our emotions? So these informations also can affect the autonomic nervous system. So pretty darn important system. And so it is broken down into classically two parts. I'll mention the third part just to kind of, no, I'll mention the first two parts first. The classic parts, you know them. You know, it's the parasympathetic system and the sympathetic nervous system. So those are the two big branches of the autonomic nervous system. There's a third big branch that I'm going to keep a secret for a few more minutes. So the parasympathetic nervous system, what is the nerve? What is the big bad nerve that serves that system? That is the question. You have 1 minute to write your answer on a card and send it to Mary Angela. Well, you know the answer to that. The big nerve is the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve, it's a cranial nerve. It comes out of the brain. And it's a very important nerve because it is going to listen to and control the heart, the lung, the GI tract, the kidneys. It even has branches to the liver, the pancreas. The vagus nerve is truly important part of the parasympathetic system. And you know that system is most active when we're relaxed. Life is good. Perhaps you've had a pleasant meal, candlelight. Room is kind of dark. That's what the parasympathetic nervous system likes. It likes slow, easy breathing. It likes a low heart rate. It likes a digestive tract that's in a comfort zone. Okay? Well, guess what the flip side is? It's the sympathetic nervous system. You all remember that is the fight or flight system. It's like the opposite of the parasympathetic. So heart rate will go up. You might feel jittery. You'll feel energized. You might be breathing fast. Your heart is racing. So this is the system you need when, you know, life is stressful or you're in danger. You have to energize the heart and the lung. But do you really turn on the GI tract when you're running from, you know, the grizzly bear? No, the GI tract gets shut down under stress of the sympathetic nervous system. That's the epinephrine, the norepinephrine, the cortisol goes up, and so on. So those two systems, you know, in most of us, most of the day are in a balance. We hope there's a little more parasympathetic than sympathetic tone, if you will. But the body is constantly needing to adjust to the internal milieu, what's happening inside to keep things in balance, while also needs to adjust for what's going on around us. Quite a deal. And so you all have had episodes, I know, where there's really good parasympathetic kind of tone going in your life versus other times when sympathetic is dominant. And by the way, if you were going to wonder about the third system of the autonomic nervous system, it's the enteric nervous system. The enteric nervous system, those are all the neurons in your esophagus, stomach, small bowel, colon. There are as many neurons in your GI tract as there are in your spinal cord. So there are as many neurons in your GI tract as your spinal cord. So the GI tract is that important. It's got its own nervous system. And of course, that nervous system talks to the parasympathetic nervous systems so that it can be, you know, coordinated with those two systems. But, you know, obviously digestion, absorption of nutrients is crucial to any organism. So the GI tract has that special additional neural coordination and integration. So, you know, that's a sort of an overview of the autonomic nervous system. So if we kind of look at the stomach for a moment, so when the vagus nerve is active, let's say you're about to eat, and the vagus nerve is in charge of stimulating the secretion of acid, so your food can be digested. The vagus nerve contributes to the stomach's contractions, the peristaltic waves. But you know, the peristaltic waves are also taken care of by the pacemaker cells of the stomach. The stomach has its own pacemaker. In fact, it can get along without the vagus in some cases. The vagus gets cut for a lot of reasons. And in some patients, you know, it doesn't make that much of a difference. The stomach has its own pacemakers. We talked about that in the past. Those cells are the interstitial cells of Cajal, very famous cells that are the pacemaker cells of the gut. So the vagus, though, is important in modulating. The vagus nerve has a lot of ability to sense what's going on. It's not just the sort of dictator. It's actually sensing what's happening in the stomach in terms of relaxation, contractions, tone, and even rhythm. I mean, it's sensing what's happening. And it also helps control the sphincters. So this is the delicate balance going on with parasympathetic times when you're eating. And ideally, you know, you're comfortably full. There's just pleasantness going on after eating in the normal situation. On the other hand, you know, if the grizzly bear is spotted while you're about to sit down for your camp meal of beans and I don't know, what else do you have at camp? Some kind of beans and stew. Well, you know, the sympathetic system is charged. The epinephrine, norepinephrine shuts down the stomach, inhibits acid, inhibits contraction of the stomach. So that you can put all of your body's autonomic effort into getting the heart rate and the oxygenation to the lungs and the blood flow to the legs jacked up, because now it's time for fight or flight. So you see, there's a lot of going on there in the balance of autonomic nervous system and the various organs that the autonomic nervous system does control. So of course, there's a whole range of autonomic nervous system, neurologic diseases, disorders, but, you know, one that affects a number of patients with gastroparesis is an autonomic nervous system problem of control of blood pressure, heart rate. And I know some of you have this disorder. The diagnosis has been made. And we're going to talk a little bit about POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. It's easier to say POTS. So, but what is it? You know, so what it basically means is that when a patient with POTS stands up, gets up out of a chair, there can be a sense of lightheadedness. There can even be passing out. And a number of patients have waves of nausea. That actually brings on waves of nausea. Now, when most of us stand up, of course, we feel fine. You don't have any problem. You don't have any symptom. You just kind of pop up and go. And you see, that's because the autonomic nervous system took care of you. And what did the autonomic nervous system do? Well, when you stand up, temporarily for a few seconds, there's not as much blood flow to your heart. The blood is temporarily in the veins, in the periphery. And during that time, the autonomic nervous system instantly senses that, and it raises your heart rate. You're not even aware of it, raises your heart rate to maintain blood pressure. Raises the heart rate, maintains, increases the blood pressure, so you don't feel anything. So in a POTS patient, postural, orthostatic, the POTS patient sits up too fast, blood pools, the heart rate may really race. It really goes up. Why? Because the blood pressure fails to follow. The blood pressure fails to increase. The blood pressure falls. And of course, that's why the symptoms come on. The body's trying to cope with falling blood pressure. And if the brain doesn't get enough blood flow, you get lightheaded, and some people actually, pass out. And so that's what POTS is. And then there's other symptoms that you can have with POTS as well. But the one that I became quite aware of in the realm of nausea, which I've studied for many years, what is nausea? What are the causes of nausea? Actually, my introduction to this disorder came from my interactions with a faculty member here at Wake Forest in pediatric gastroenterology. John Fortunato was a neuromuscular expert interested in motility disorders in kids. And he, and POTS is most very common in kids. And he kept seeing these kids who also complained of not only near syncope and syncope, but really a lot of nausea. And so he studied these kids with formal tilt table tests, and found that that there was a very high incidence of nausea as these kids went through the actual test. I'll describe it in a moment. And as they did that, they had classic POTS, but a lot of nausea. And various hormones like vasopressin went sky high. I just mentioned that in passing because I used to study vasopressin in the setting of acute nausea due to motion sickness. When you have a motion sickness, this vasopressin hormone goes quite high and actually correlated pretty well with nausea. And in the acute situation of the POTS patient, vasopressin goes pretty high. They're very nauseated. In any case, he did some studies where with replacing with a drug that helped patients hold on to salt, hold on to water. It's like a prednisone. These patients actually had less passing out and less nausea. So anyway, this all led me to begin to ask my patients who have gastroparesis and nausea, how do they feel when they, not just after they eat, not just what kind of foods brought on their nausea, but when they stand up, do they become nauseated? When they stand up, are there waves of nausea and a little lightheadedness? And when I would hear that, then I would send them for a formal tilt table test. And a formal tilt table test is still the best way to diagnose POTS. I'll take a moment to describe that test, but it should be done on a special table. You've got your blood pressure monitored, your pulse monitored. There may be other things that are monitored. These are often done, by the way, in cardiology sections. And over 45 minutes, the patient is slowly tilted to almost upright, and then at the upright position, that's held for a number of minutes. And so blood pressure, pulse, and symptoms are being recorded during this whole time. And then based on what the heart rate does, based on what the blood pressure does, one makes these various diagnoses related to orthostatic, or orthostatic simply meaning, you know, lying down, standing up. What kind of heart and blood pressure changes happen? And that's how these different diagnoses of orthostatic intolerance, which POTS is one, these diagnoses are then established. And so basically, I started ordering those tests when I heard these histories. And you know, in one study, and of course we're not taking all comers with gastroparesis. We're taking gastroparotic patients who have this orthostatic standing up, nausea plus lightheadedness, near syncope. In that kind of a selection, we probably found 20% of the patients, you know, had a positive tilt table test and a real diagnosis of POTS. I say real diagnosis because you have to be careful. You know, you can't go into the tilt table test if you're dehydrated. If you're having a bad week of gastroparesis flares and you're barely keeping up with fluids, that's not the good time to have a tilt table test, right? They will show you're dehydrated and maybe miss the POTS. So you really have to have a tilt table test when you're well hydrated. Because despite being well hydrated, these findings will still come about. So basically then, if the POTS diagnosis is made, then I have found in our area, there are very few cardiologists, very few docs who are really interested and passionate about POTS treatments. Very difficult, you can imagine. It's difficult enough to try to help a stomach whose nerve and muscle and pacemaker isn't quite right. So to try to use drugs to help the autonomic nervous system balance is a real art, I must say. So, but it does start with some simple things like salt, you know, 10 grams of salt a day, and at least a liter of Gatorade to keep as hydrated as possible. And then they have drugs that might affect heart rate. Some people's heart rates are too fast, others are too slow, and some people's, there's drugs to help blood pressure. So they have a whole bag of drugs and different aspects that one does to try to treat POTS. So you can see why that's a real big deal if you have also documented gastric dysrhythmia with or without gastroparesis. You already have a problem with finessing the stomach in terms of your diet and drugs. And that's it. That gastroparesis has its own set of symptoms that we try to deal with. And then in addition, you have POTS, you know, that's just another diagnosis. It's important to make it because, you know, sometimes if I don't seem to be making any headway with the gastroparesis management, I ought to be thinking about, well, is there something else going on? Does this patient actually have another issue? And perhaps that issue is, you know, POTS. And then well, at least there's some POTS treatments that are different than gastroparesis treatments, and together, you know, get you the patient can feel better because both problems are identified, both are being treated. Wow. So there's how's that? I mean, I could maybe stop there, Mary Angela, because I feel like I've gone from the great big bad autonomic nervous system, and then kind of focused on what the stomach does, and then we've touched on the POTS and the gastroparesis. Maybe it is time for some questions or comments.
Yeah, it's so thorough as usual. It's so comprehensive when you're explaining these things. So you make understanding it very easy. And so it's important, once again, just to stress that when some people have an autonomic testing and the results come out negative, but other times it may be positive, because it varies from institution to institution. So having that test, can you just expand upon the time it takes to do that test?
Yes. Because I'm only aware of what we have here at Wake Forest. It's offered through cardiology, and it's a special table in a special room, and it's a 45-minute test before the entire tilt upright is completed. I think there are shorter versions there. We even did a version at one point, if any of you participated in our NIH gastroparesis registry, where there was basically sitting on a chair and then standing up, you know, in the office, and you stand up for like 5 minutes, and that's it. So there are simpler versions. Sometimes, of course, in the clinic, if we think somebody's dehydrated, we get blood pressure and pulse laying down, and then we have them stand up for 5 minutes, and we get blood pressure and pulse standing up. You know, that's not a tilt test. I mean, that's an orthostatic blood pressure test we do we're really looking for dehydration. And so, you know, if the blood pressure, you know, falls 10 millimeters of mercury and the pulse goes up, in the clinic, we would say you are dehydrated. And, you know, that's then we get fluids and may need IV fluids. I may need a liter of IV fluids and emphasize that to help that particular finding. So that's not a tilt table test. As I mentioned, the tilt table should be at least a 45-minute test.
And can you also explain how do POTS and problems with the autonomic nervous system, how do they influence the severity or even the presence of gastroparesis, the symptoms of gastroparesis?
Yeah, so I think that they certainly can, I think the big question there is, you know, we have a lot of patients with idiopathic gastroparesis. And if you just, a big question might be, well, where'd that come from? Idiopathic means we don't know. And we do think about half of our patients have had viral infections. You know, it's a post-viral damage to the stomach that doesn't quite recover. We've seen it after, many courses of antibiotics. You know, did the antibiotics somehow hurt the pacemaker cells, the neurons? But there are other people where nobody knows exactly. There is no clue that we could even pretend to understand. And so it's possible, you know, that some patients' gastroparesis has come from an autonomic nervous system dysfunction, the parasympathetic, sympathetic control that gets stuck, and the stomach simply doesn't respond normally. You know, it has dysrhythmia, it doesn't empty. You know, but the problem is that may be true, but you wouldn't see it on a CAT scan, you wouldn't see it on an MRI. This is too subtle. So we don't know if this autonomic nervous system problem created the gastroparesis. If there's no other cause in the history, you might say, well, why not? Because you also have POTS. We define POTS. Your autonomic nervous system is abnormal in terms of the heart rate and the vascular response to standing up. That piece of the autonomic nervous system is off. Now that piece is affecting your heart and blood vessels. Could it also be affecting your Stomach, well, yes, it could, but we just don't know. We don't know that for sure. So they could be related in terms of cause, but sometimes I just tell my patients, well, you've got these two problems. They may be related, they may not be related, but you certainly have both of them. And so this is this then tells us, let's treat two things. We've got two disorders. We are treating them both aggressively as possible.
And I guess the last question that I want to ask, and there may not be an answer, is, so we'll never know which came first, the POTS or the gastroparesis.
Yeah.
Gastroparesis came first, and then even autonomic, the effects of the autonomic nervous system, if all that came before or after.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to, if we ever... if there ever was a series, or to my knowledge, nobody has, you know, diagnosed POTS in, let's take 100 people, and they presented with a little bit of nausea or a lot of nausea and syncope, and POTS was diagnosed, and somebody at that time checked the electrical rhythm, checked the gastric emptying, and was normal. And then you go 6 months, 12 months, a year. You know, you'd have to do that. That's called like a natural history study. If you follow those 100 POTS patients over who knows how long, at some point, do they get more symptoms associated with gastroparesis? And you could say, yeah, 100 POTS patients followed for 10 years, you know, 20 now have POTS and gastroparesis. Do you see what I mean? These are very difficult kind of things to study. You need that kind of longitudinal look. At least that would be a classic way to see which one came first. Alternatively, I guess all of our patients with gastroparesis, gee whiz, I guess you could test everybody for POTS and see at some point along the gastroparesis history, does POTS dive in? So, you know, these are the big questions. Where are these things coming from and why? Those are great questions.
Well, thank you for all those answers. I think because of the amount of people we have with questions, I'm going to leave this to Melissa, and she's going to ask some of the questions and have the audience participate. Is that all right with you, Dr. Cook?
Yeah, just please. I'm curious what kind of questions are out there.
In general, some of them you have already answered. One of the most common questions was which came first, the gastroparesis or the POTS, and whether there's a correlation. So you sort of answered that one. I would say the second most common question we got had to do with treatments. And there are some people who may be on the call who might ask you about some specific treatments. But in general, can you discuss what the treatments are for POTS and whether those treatments can actually interfere with the gastroparesis treatments or vice versa, gastroparesis interfere with the POTS treatments?
Yeah. Well, that's an important question too. So, you know, and I'm not a, I don't treat POTS, and so I'm not saying that my answers are going to be totally on the mark, but commonly I see people put on a drug that will raise the blood pressure. It's called Midodrine. So that drug stimulates blood pressure or vascular smooth muscle to contract better. So when the patient stands up, they're already ahead of the game. The blood pressure is already will be boosted and helped by this drug Midodrine. And to my knowledge, the drug Midodrine doesn't do anything for gastric emptying, better or worse. Another drug I've seen used, some people's heart rate goes too high, and it's so high that the high heart rate is a problem. and beta blockers like propranolol I've seen patients on to kind of help moderate that heart rate variability. And to my knowledge and my experience, you know, propranolol has not influenced my patient's gastroparesis symptoms. And then I've seen a drug that will help the cholinergic, kind of the parasympathetic system, and because that you don't want that to be totally weak either. And there's ways to determine that during the POTS testing, the tilt table test. And that's a drug called Mestinon. Some of you may be on it. It's also called pyridostigmine, and it is a drug that blocks an enzyme so that you'll have more acetylcholine. And I'll see a patient with POTS come to me and they're already on that drug, and I use that drug for gastroparesis. So that's kind of a win-win one there. So there are other drugs that the cardiologists know that I don't, but those are the ones that I see, and I have no problem with those drugs and my patients with gastroparesis. They just, in my experience, do not do anything bad, and I don't know if they're doing anything good for the gastroparesis, except for the Mestinon I mentioned. And so, and I tell my patients too, of course, you know, I don't like nausea, but you can't be fainting. You can't be, you know, lightheaded or having syncopal spells. So it's really important that they stay hydrated. I'll reemphasize the 10 grams of salt a day, and to drink as much Gatorade or electrolyte liquids as they can, maybe a liter or more. Maybe they need more to make sure they're not dehydrated. So basically, yeah, those are some of the drugs, and I don't think they're, in my experience, they have not been a problem in managing the gastroparesis symptoms.
Okay. And have you found that if you somehow improve the gastroparesis or improve the POTS, does the other condition sometimes improve as well?
Yeah, I don't, you know, these things, really, I'd have to say no. It's just that if you can get some symptomatic relief in either one, the patient's just better. They're better for, both are better, I think. The intermittent standing up, sitting down, is all those symptoms are better when POTS is treated well. As well as it can be. And the same is true for the gastroparesis. So I really tell patients to get back to their POTS doctor, do everything, is that doctor doing everything he can do to optimize those symptoms related? And then quite separately, I'm working on the gastroparesis and related symptoms. So I still think of them as two separate things, and you know, really getting one well is great for symptoms, but I really don't think it's influencing the other entity.
Interesting, very interesting. We did have some other specific questions submitted. Miss Erin, are you on the call?
Did you say Karen?
Erin, E-R-I-N. I think I see her, but she's muted at the moment. Okay, Ms. Karen, did you have a question?
I was diagnosed in 2005 with dermatomyositis, and I just got off a call with my pulmonologist. Each year things get more complex. I was diagnosed with gastroparesis probably 4 or 5 years ago, but he was very thorough. It was a telehealth visit, and I haven't met him in person before, but I was really impressed. And he was going through my history, and I realized that I had severe nausea as a child, and that switched with my first pregnancy. Then I got explosive diarrhea. Instead of throwing up all the time, I had diarrhea. And then, like I said, I was diagnosed with dermatomyositis in 2005, and then gastroparesis finally a few years ago. So I'm just curious how my lifelong digestive things, if they are related at all. This dermatomyositis, of course, has weakened my my upper body and my muscles, and I ended up in the emergency room in February, and they have found that now I have severe reflux that was affecting my caused inflammation in my lung area. Even though my lung and heart look fine now, I have this terrible inflammation because of this really bad gastric reflux that I thought that I had controlled for the last 10 years. So,
yes. Well, may I ask, how old are you?
I will be, in a couple of months, will be 64.
Okay. And could you tell us, like, the weakness part of it? What do you have? What do you experience in terms of the weakness part of?
It's my, I've always had upper body weakness. I always had stronger legs and could walk and ride a bicycle, but I've always had difficulty lifting things. And of course, after I caught some kind of virus, so I'm very understanding of long COVID patients, because I caught some kind of virus in February of 2004, and I just never got better. Got to the point, getting out of a shower would just exhaust me and I just go back to bed. Luckily I had a very understanding employer at the time who gave me plenty of time off, and finally had a large muscle biopsy of my shoulder where most of my weakness was, and it came back that I had the dermatomyositis. So I've always had upper body weakness.
Yeah, well, so this, thank you for sharing all this, because it really illustrates a slightly different approach to injury to two areas. You know, we kind of talked about the autonomic nervous system, but here we're talking about the muscle system. Remember, it's dermatomyositis. Myositis means inflammation of the muscles, but the muscles we're talking about here are the, like, shoulder, arms, you know, I guess early on, maybe even the legs, you know, trouble getting out of a shower and so on. But that's a striated muscle problem, inflammation. So, you know, striated muscle has actin and myosin. Those are the proteins that are needed to have a muscle contract and relax. Okay. Well, guess what? The GI tract, the stomach, the sphincters, and so on, they're made out of smooth muscle, right? They're smooth muscle. They're out of your control. They, unlike the striated muscles, they're quite different. But guess where they're the same? They have actin and myosin. You know, they just don't have as densely packed actin and myosin, because they contract and relax much differently. But they're old studies, and I quote them in my chapters I've written. But there are small series of patients with dermatomyositis who actually have gastroparesis, and the stomachs are weak, and they are probably related in that inflammation. If there's a virus that doesn't like actin and myosin, think of that virus going through your body. It doesn't like actin or myosin, so it doesn't care if the actin and myosin is in your shoulder or in your stomach antrum. It sees actin, it sees myosin, and it may unfortunately damage it, as viruses can damage any number of organs and tissues, and then your body tries to recover. And so I think this would go along with your, in other words, I think your gastroparesis and gastroparesis, these are most likely very related. Can involve the GI tract. And that's probably what you're experiencing.
Okay, thank you. I will go ahead and read Ms. Aaron's question. I do believe she's on the call, but for some reason she is unable to unmute. So I'll go ahead and read the question that she submitted for her. Okay. She would like to know if patients with both POTS and gastroparesis are more likely to become dependent on enteral nutrition or TPN than patients with gastroparesis alone.
Yeah, that's another good question. And so the answer to that is yes, because there are really, you know, two hits here. It's not just the stomach part, it's the orthostatic part. And so you've got two potential reasons to become nauseated, not feel like eating, not feel like drinking. And so I've seen a number of POTS patients who what they really need is IV fluids, not so much for their nutrition, but you know, their POTS is so bad, they'll get a liter or even two of like normal saline every day or every other day or twice a week, because it's the standing up and fainting or you know, feeling faint, is and the nausea. That's actually a bigger deal than the gastroparesis. So really remember, we talked about salt and water, but if you could, some people need the salt and water, you know, through a port, through an IV, and that's enough to make them feel well enough that they can cope with their gastroparesis. I guess in a really bad case where both are bad, then, and you can't nourish yourself because of feeling nauseated and the gastroparesis, then with TPN, of course, with that TPN solution, you're getting volume, you're getting salt and the nutrients. And so I think in general that if it's a bad combination, or if each of those POTS and gastroparesis are particularly bad, yeah, that group is going to be more likely to need some kind of support with IV fluids or the TPN.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
Another question we had submitted from Corey, and I believe Corey's also on the call. Corey, would you like to ask your question? Or if not, I can read it for you. Okay, I will go ahead and read it. Corey says, I'm a dysautonomia patient receiving IVIG therapy. I had gastric problems before any other issues occurred, cyclic vomiting, acid reflux, and IBS type issues. IVIG isn't changing my GI symptoms. Has your research indicated anything else, any other testing or treatments that might help me?
Yeah, so that's interesting progression. I think she said that kind of had cyclic vomiting syndrome and some other GI ailments, and then the dysautonomia seemed to be discovered. And yeah, the IV immunoglobulin therapy, you know, people try it, and I think it's a there's some minority of patients who respond to it. It's actually being given in some centers in small trials for gastroparesis, you know, just to try to stimulate or help the immune system, you know, fight off some suspected but unknown inflammation. You know, in the end, perhaps, and we're growing to think these are chronic inflammatory conditions, you know, but they're super subtle. This is not like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis where you've got bloody diarrhea. These are more subtle than that. But, you know, I do think that there are some inflammatory markers, even in gastroparesis. You know, but it's not like white blood cells. It's not like eosinophils for allergies. These are macrophages. These are very chronic, old, you might say, inflammatory cells that get into the tissue and destroy nerves or the pacemaker cells for sure. And so there's ideas that these give these immunoglobulins and it may help, but I think it's early. I think it's still trying to figure out who it might help and who it really doesn't help. So those folks don't have to go through it in the future. So I think it sounds like she's you're at a fairly state-of-the-art treatment. And yeah, I'm not aware of other things they might want to try after IVIG. I think that's fairly avant-garde.
Okay, thank you. Miss Jacqueline had a question about finding a doctor. Miss Jacqueline, are you on the call? Okay. Jacqueline asks, how do I find a doctor who is familiar with gastroparesis and some of these other comorbid conditions? And I guess I would add to that question, if you must have separate doctors for those conditions, what kind of tips do you have for getting them to collaborate and coordinate your care?
Yeah. You know, I recently had a patient in a city who was looking for a motility doctor, and our, and maybe this is something Mary Angela does want to have, but our American Motility Society, the Neurogastro and Motility Society, has a pretty long list. It's not every city, but a pretty long list of cities where they list physicians who are. In fact, I have that list. I may send it to Mary Angela, because that's kind of a secret list. I mean, people don't advertise about, doctors don't advertise this specialty. Someday they will, I think. It's the symptoms are so common, we can do more and more as we learn more and more about these entities. So that would be a start. This our Motility Society has a list, but again, I don't know that it's posted on our site, but it should be, and I will look into that. Okay. Yeah. Otherwise, I guess your own family doctor, often they know who in town is interested and willing to see patients with these kinds of disorders. And actually, in terms of collaborating with the other doctors, I have occasionally spoken to my POTS cardiology doctor, but I must say in today's running around busy medicine, you know, you probably only call somebody up during their day if there's some strange issue going on. Otherwise, I say, man, get your patient better. And if I think they're that the POTS could be treated better, or you have a lot of symptoms, I'll say, please get back to that POTS doctor and say, you know, things aren't working so well. What's next? What's next that I should try? Just like when the patient comes back to me and they're not doing that well, you say, well, what's next? What do we try next? Because this is not something that's stamped out like a, should, dare I say, a cookbook. You know, it's not a cookbook recipe. Patients have to be individualized what is done. So, but there may or may not be much, you know, talking together unless there's sort of a problem that's not being solved by one or both. So I would just try to find these docs and see what they say.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And we do have a list on the AGMD website of some clinics that treat different dysmotility conditions. So that might be a starting point as well. But I was interested in how the collaboration might work, and that's very well answered. Thank you.
Yeah, all the way from 0 to 100%. Just kind of depends how the patient's doing.
And is Ms. Dawn on the call? I'm striking out here. Miss Dawn would like to know, she says, I also have pure autonomic failure. Is this something that happens frequently?
What's it called again? Is you say pure?
Pure autonomic failure.
Yeah, so that may be a neurology term and a neurology diagnosis. And so I'm not myself sure what that means. If she was on the line, we could hear her symptoms. But, you know, I don't know what the actual pure means, if that means both sympathetic and parasympathetic are out. But sorry, I'm not familiar with that term.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Thank you. And Miss Suzanne, are you on the call? Okay. Miss Suzanne asks, can low dose naltrexone help with gastroparesis or BOTS?
Yeah, good question. Naltrexone is a medicine that kind of blocks the mu, or the, which is basically an opioid receptor. The opioids like morphine, Dilaudid, they really shut the GI tract down. Man, they slow gastric emptying. They slow the small bowel. They slow the colon. So they slow everything. And it's interesting, there are almost no studies on, does this drug, you know, given to 100 people with gastroparesis, or, and I'm not aware, I don't remember any patients that I've seen with POTS come to the office with their doctors having been on prescribed naltrexone. So if the GI tract and that those opioid receptors are inhibitory, it's not a bad idea. Maybe I should try it, but you know, there's a lot, obviously there's a lot of drugs out there, but you know, they weren't designed for gastroparesis. So nobody studies them. They're already approved for something else. And this is, some docs might try it and say this or that, the next thing. So no real data on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting. And I know we're getting low on time, so I'm going to pass it back over to Mary Angela in just a second. But I would like to thank you personally again for attending these calls, for hosting these calls. I think it's so brave of you to just open yourself up to random questions from patients. You never know what you're going to get. And I just want to let you know how much we appreciate you doing this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you, Melissa, for heading that. Dr. Cook, as always, we are just immeasurably grateful for all your time and your dedication and your passion in helping patients. We are just incredibly fortunate to have you do these programs for AGMD and know that you continue to touch countless lives by all that you do. Thank you again, and thank you, Melissa, for assisting with us here today. And to all of you, with all your struggles you go through, I want you to know you're not alone. You remain in my thoughts, in my prayers, in my heart always. You are the quiet heroes, and I thank you for being here today. May God bless you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you.